Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
In terms of prices, we know that maintaining coal and gas for longer is actually the worst thing you can do for energy prices. The best thing you can do is bring in renewables as fast as possible.
Queensland's coal-fired power stations will operate for at least a decade longer than originally planned. Also,
so some airports are already doing this. Once you get to the terminal, there are coordinators who are greeting you and taking you through your entire journey, and then at the other end as well. Some airports have been trialling that.
The government's new aviation white paper will improve the rights of people with disability when travelling. And later today,
the big issue for carers is not just the burden of care and the responsibility that goes with it. It's about being able to access supports that are relevant to them and safe for them, where they will feel safe and accepted.
LGBTIQ plus carers face greater challenges in accessing support. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network, and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, more Australians are falling under the poverty line, according to the latest report from the Australian Council of Social Services and the University of New South Wales. The Poverty in Australia report shows over 3.5 million people were living in poverty in 2022 to 2023. While the government has made improvements to some social security payments, advocates say there's still a long way to go. Political reporter Noah Seckham has the story.
The findings of the report are clear. Poverty is on the rise. From 1 in 8 in the last report to 1 in 7 in 2022-23, with the figure increasing for children to 1 in 6. Senior research fellow Dr. Yuvasthi Naidu at the University of New South Wales Social Policy Research Centre was one of the people helping to develop the report. She says housing costs are outpacing welfare payments and says there is a clear trend of more Australians falling behind.
There are, of course, longer term systemic issues that we need to address that in part have been done, but things like Work for the Dole, for example, was not successful in actually reducing unemployment or even long term unemployment. So I think long term unemployment has gone up to around 60% in 2024, which is very high. Very high. It means that people who have been unemployed for a very long time have a very high risk of not being employable in the future.
Another gap in policy noted in the report is that the government does not measure poverty, something first raised after the first federal inquiry into poverty in the mid-1970s. The Henderson report was handed down in 1975, and Dr. Naidu says little has shifted in the decades since.
At the time, the Henderson poverty line was set up based on $73 for a basic wage plus a child endowment for a two-person family with two children, where it was based on the traditional male breadwinner model. The Henderson poverty line has been tracked since then, right? We don't use that anymore for many reasons. There was a lot of momentum around then, and then through successive governments, even though Bob Hawke mentioned the ending of child poverty, there has been very little systemic, profound, impactful change in the last 50 years that have made a big difference. We've had minor adjustments to the national minimum wage. We've had minor adjustments to working age income support payments. We've had minor provisions of social housing stock, but there's not been a profound change in the way that we set up the social security system, the way we compensate and move people out of unemployment, and the way that we sustain employment over the long term, and the way that we lift up income support payments that allow people at least with the flexibility and the capacity to get work and to move out of poverty. So what we have in our academic work, we actually talk about the chronic poor, the transient poor, the always poor, usually poor, never poor. And what we found is that there is a group of people who are always in poverty. And that includes many children who are in poverty now and whose likelihood of being in poverty in the future is also very high.
ACOS CEO Cassandra Goldie says a social and political shift is needed to address poverty for the long term.
We have a culture in Australia which should disturb all of us, that we have treated people on low incomes as if there's something wrong with you, that it's all your fault, that you are to blame. And then if I'm doing really well, then it's because I'm a better person and I did something right. Well, the truth is something profoundly different. In a wealthy country, it's often very hard for people who have fallen into poverty to speak up and be public about that. There is a lot of shame that can be attached to this experience. I often get asked, well, yes, that'd be great, but how do we afford it? Well, there's two parts to that. We can't afford not to. I mean, if we want to see young people stay in further education to get themselves ready to take on the AI revolution and to make sure that people on lower incomes are not just completely left behind, you've got to have enough to house yourself and feed yourself. It's pretty basic. And universities and tertiary institutions are speaking to us about how they cannot keep up with the food banks. That's what's going on for young people trying to study, is they are hungry. So we can't afford not to tackle this from that point of view in terms of, you know, the human condition, what we're prepared to tolerate. But also from a fiscal point of view, we are overall a very wealthy country. We're the second wealthiest amongst OECD countries by wealth. We have been able to find billions and billions, over 30 billion in tax cuts. We were able to find the money for that. In the lead up to the last budget, we found another 7 billion per year in the tax cuts, which of course went to everybody who was earning enough income to be able to contribute to the tax system through income taxes. Now, remember that people on very low incomes do contribute to the tax system through the GST, but they certainly didn't get any help from the billions and billions that were spent in tax cuts.
Today, the Treasurer has announced an alternative approach to superannuation reform, which he says will make the system fairer. When asked about the poverty figures, Jim Chalmers defended the government's record.
To help people on low and fixed incomes, we're doing it today with the changes to the low-income super tax offset. We've done it with a permanent ongoing increase to JobSeeker. We've done it with rent assistance. We've done it with energy bill relief. And I respect people and value people who say that we should do more and to do things faster. We do things as much as we responsibly can from budget to budget.
Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young says Labor isn't prioritising vulnerable households.
You shouldn't just be able to game the system because you're rich enough to get a good accountant. We continue to hear all the time, a government doesn't have the revenue for paying for this and paying for that. It is about choice.
Cassandra Goldie says while she welcomes any additional support for low-income Australians, the announcement today highlights the two worlds in the Australian economy.
The tax concessions in superannuation are costing $50 billion this year. They're the tax breaks for people who are able to accumulate savings in a superannuation fund at the same time as we've got one in seven people, including one in six children living in poverty, who are still waiting for the expenditures that are going to help them to be able to keep a roof over their head and feed themselves three times a day.
Political reporter Noah Seckham ending that report.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Queensland's coal-fired power stations will operate for at least a decade longer than originally planned, as revealed in the Chris Afully government's long-awaited energy roadmap. On Friday, Queensland Treasurer and Energy Minister David Janetsky said the plan would see some state-owned coal assets run until at least 2046. Conservationists and energy analysts have criticised the government's energy plan, saying Queenslanders will now be stuck with expensive and unreliable energy while increasing damage to the climate. To hear more about the energy plan and the risk of keeping ageing power stations active for longer, I spoke to WWF Australia Senior Manager of Climate and Energy Policy, Ariane Wilkinson.
The Queensland government hasn't ruled out further extensions of coal-fired power stations into the future. It commits to bringing in new gas-fired power and actually a $1.6 billion fund to prop up the coal and bring in the gas. This is something that's of huge concern to WWF Australia. It's not in line with taking climate action. It's not in line with doing Queensland's part in reducing emissions to protect our lifestyle and our natural environment.
What are the costs and risks associated with keeping these ageing power stations in the system for longer?
We're basically planning on using the most expensive form of energy now. The jury's out, and renewables backed by storage are the cheapest form of energy. So investing in them is not only good for our energy prices, it actually puts Queensland on the front foot of the transition and brings in clean industries into the regions. So by backing extending coal-fired power and backing in new gas, we've actually started putting Queensland in the complete wrong direction.
Presents a big risk for Queensland missing out on major clean energy investment while it's kind of still in the pipeline. What kind of opportunities could the state gain if it set clear coal closure dates?
Well, coal closure dates are the most important investment signal for clean energy investors into new renewables, clean energy, not just, you know, wind and solar, but also clean industries in Queensland. So by leaving the coal closure dates both extended and really uncertain, they're essentially open indefinitely at the moment. There's a huge risk that we're going to see investment flight from Queensland, Queensland missing out to other states and Queensland missing out to other jurisdictions. It was discussed at the release of the energy plan that Queensland is one of the jurisdictions where investors really are excited because we have some of the best renewable resources in Australia, even in the world. And we really need a plan that doesn't see that investment pipeline start to step away looking at other opportunities. And this plan doesn't cut it. This plan is a real concern.
Can you explain how climate inaction or this hesitance to set clear coal closure dates will translate into higher costs for households?
Well, the higher cost comes about because, particularly because you're bringing gas in, which is one of the most expensive forms of energy. So if there's no transition plan, no clear certainty of bringing out the coal and replacing it with renewables backed by storage, you're actually going to see a more disrupted energy transition. In terms of prices, we know that maintaining coal and gas for longer is actually the worst thing you can do for energy prices. The best thing you can do is bring in renewables as fast as possible. And that's unfortunately been something that's been stepped away from by the Queensland government in this plan.
The government says it's balancing reliability and affordability by keeping coal and gas in the mix. What's your response to those who argue coal is still needed to keep electricity reliable and affordable in the short term?
I think if we're going to talk about reliability, the real problem is the coal-fired power stations. We've seen really concerning, you know, problems with the existing coal-fired power stations in Queensland. There's this argument that they're young, but they actually do run into problems. We've seen one of them essentially blow up. You know, they're expensive to keep going. And in really severe hot weather events, and we're going to see a lot more of those in Queensland as climate change impacts increase, that's when the coal-fired power stations become really unreliable.
What kind of energy plan would you and WWF like to see from the Crisafulli government that protects both the economy and the environment?
But what we need to see is a clear and credible plan that decarbonises the electricity system in Queensland, keeps the coal closure dates as they were by 2035, and does the heavy lifting that's needed in the energy sector to actually reach Queensland's emissions reduction targets of 75% below 2005 by 2035. The Crisafulli government voted unanimously in favour of those climate targets. They brought them to the election. They've said they're not going to be changed. What we would say is, well, how are you going to meet those targets?
Ariane Wilkinson from WWF Australia there, ending that report. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. People with disabilities often face a range of systemic barriers when it comes to travelling and navigating the aviation industry. According to the Minister for Transport, the Australian government is currently in the process of co-designing 11 initiatives to mitigate these barriers. The Aviation White Paper sets out long-term policies and actions for the future of the Australian aviation industry, including improvements to the sector which would protect the rights of people with disability. Powered Media reporter Emma Myers spoke to Minister for Transport Catherine King about the barriers Australians with disability face at airports.
Well, it can be really mixed. Obviously, we've heard a lot of the stories about access with wheelchairs, particularly on planes themselves, loss and damage of wheelchairs, as well as refusal to actually fly people or you've got to the destination and people have been stuck on the plane because there isn't specific equipment to actually disembark you. So I've certainly heard those. Obviously, not all disabilities are mobility disabilities or visible, so often airports are really busy and stressful places in and of themselves. You're trying to get somewhere quickly, there's a lot of people in movement, often people are, you know, experiencing emotions from joy to sadness to anger to a whole heap of things, and airports themselves weren't really designed for people's sensory experiences. So often there's that as well. Not enough places for people to rest, long travel to get to an actual plane in the first place, let alone the other issues that people with disabilities experience just in terms of being able to book to get on a plane in the first place. There was sort of a default policy with only sort of two wheelchairs per plane, which we've stopped, or we've asked to be stopped. I understand they've got timetables and they need to make sure they do earlier pre-boarding, all of those things, but all of that is manageable operationally. So we've really said, look, you know, we think that that sort of default issue really, you know, it's a matter for the airlines, but at the end of the day, that shouldn't be something that is a barrier for people travelling if you've got more than two passengers on a plane booked who need assistance.
How are the new aviation-specific disability standards going? What stage are we at currently?
Yeah, so I actually attended one of the workshops. They're being done on a co-design principle, so with people with disabilities, but also with the industry as well. So there's lived experience of people with disabilities across a whole range of disabilities, as well as the airlines and airports themselves as well, because they've got to work out how do you practically then implement. You know, it's pretty hard to change the design of planes, but what can you do to actually adjust and to improve things? So that's where they're at the moment. They're in design stage, and it was great to have an opportunity to go and have a look at one of these workshops in practice, and everyone was pretty engaged with the issue.
And how will the Australian government ensure that airlines and airports coordinate their actions in assisting people with disability throughout their journey?
So some airports are already doing this. Once you get to the terminal, there are coordinators who are greeting you and taking you through your entire journey, and then at the other end as well. Some airports have been trialling that. That's been working well. But really what the standards do is they say these are the standards that you must comply with. They're in regulation or law, and then the airports and airlines must comply with those. That is part of their operating, is that they actually have to do that.
You would have heard countless stories of discrimination of people specifically with mobility aids and their treatment by airline staff. What mechanisms will be put in place to review and publicly report on industry compliance with the new aviation standards?
No one wants to see an incident like that. There are obviously already provisions under the Disability Discrimination Act, but certainly I think one of the things that, you know, we will need to look at is what the reporting is. So which airlines are doing better, which airports are doing better. What we want to do though is see continuous improvement. What we don't want to do is necessarily beat people about the head. What we want to do is say to the airlines and the airports, you've got an obligation here to meet the standards, to improve what you actually do for people with disabilities. And as I said, it's great to see them starting that and starting the conversations and working their way through that. But the standards really then will be an obligation on them to do. And what I'd like to see is a system of continuous improvement. Will we ever get it so it's so 100% perfect? I don't think any system ever is. There's always going to be breakdowns, but it's what we learn from them and how we change them that's really what I want to see improve within airports and airlines.
Minister for Transport Catherine King there, speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers.
different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
Becoming a carer is complex, but when a carer is part of the LGBTIQ plus community, it's more challenging than expected. According to Carers Queensland, between 15 and 30% of the LGBTIQ plus population is currently in a caring role, facing challenges like discrimination, isolation, and access to affordable, inclusive services. To hear more about the challenges and service access, The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Regional Manager at Carers Queensland, Rebecca Binion.
I think I've seen research that says up to 30% of LGBT adults identify as carers, which is a huge number. What we know about being part of the LGBT community is that people can struggle to feel comfortable with mainstream services. So when they're reaching out for support, they don't feel like they might be treated with respect for their identity. Their relationships might be not seen as equal. Even though we have legislation that protects that, obviously it's about how we feel. And we know that in our community, lots of LGBTI people, LGBTQIA plus people, are actually dealing with trauma. And as a result, they're really hypervigilant about whether they're going to be accepted and treated well in community. So the big issue for carers is not just the burden of care and the responsibility that goes with it. It's about being able to access supports that are relevant to them and safe for them, where they will feel safe and accepted. And the same for the people they care for. So we know that for a lot of people with disability and a lot of elderly people, actually getting services that are LGBTQIA friendly is a real challenge. So if you're a carer and say you're looking for some respite care, getting that service that is going to respect your partner or your child or your, you know, your parent for who they are is quite the challenge. And Carers Queensland is really interested in how we can work with the LGBT community and find better ways for people to do that. And we as a service have a safe channel for people to access. So you can contact us on our rainbow@carerscqueensland.com.au email address. And when you get a response from us, it'll be from one of our LGBTQIA staff, because we have about 10 to 14% of our staff as LGBTQIA plus.
So what is Carers Queensland advocating, you know, on a state level or even a federal government, if you're doing that work, on giving better access to support for the LGBTIQ plus community in this sense?
Well, look, I think very much our sort of advocacy work is something that's in its infancy. As an organisation, we are promoting sort of general supports at the moment because we know there's not even enough mainstream supports. We are using our connections with LGBT community and our staff to inform the types of things that we're asking for. So I'm wearing a T-shirt today that on the back it says Stronger Together, and it's got the flags of First Nations representatives, symbols that represent disability, LGBT community and the multicultural community. And that's because we firmly believe that any services and supports and improvements in services for community need to be made so that all of those communities can feel safe and able to access them. So we understand that there's a lot of intersectionality, obviously, in carers, but also in the LGBT community. So services need to be tailored and they need to be culturally safe.
And where can the public know more about the services Carers Queensland provide and their other services that you can let us know about?
So you can contact us on carerscqueensland.com.au. You can just go to our website. If you want to contact us with a specific question, once again, contact us at rainbow@carerscqueensland.com.au, and one of our lovely LGBTQIA plus staff will respond to you. And if you let us know if you'd rather have a phone call or an email or a text, we'll do that. We've also got a 1300 number, which is on the website. So please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. And we really want to work with community to get better services and supports for carers and for the people they care for. The reason actually behind me wearing this Stronger Together message on the back of our T-shirt is that we recently lost a very valued member of our leadership team who was originally from El Salvador. And she was just a beautiful woman who embodied the sense that inclusion is about everybody. She wasn't LGBT, but she came to every one of the marches over the last 4 years since she's been working with us and always came with her son. And we just said, you know, to honour her, we really are motivated and driven to the idea that inclusion really is about everybody, and that includes in the LGBT community. We've got to do a better job at working with each other and supporting people and understanding the struggles that each of the communities have, and that we're often fighting the same fight for services, for support and for understanding of our experience and for respect for our identity. So,
Rebecca Binion from Carers Queensland there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries on which this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.